stay curious. That is a longevity strategy. Stay curious about your surroundings, about the world, about yourself. Stay curious.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome to At Home on Air. I'm Susie Stadler, an architect by profession, the executive director of At Home with Growing Older, and the producer of this podcast. In our interviews, we explore the meaning of being at home with growing older from two angles: how we can adapt our living environments, including our cities, to better support us as we age, and how we can continue to cultivate a sense of belonging within our communities and ourselves. These explorations are made possible through the insights of inspiring guests from the arts, architecture, medicine, social services, and beyond, and through comments and questions from you, our listeners. So thank you for being here. In this fourth episode in our interview series with changemakers, people who have made and still make a difference in our lives by telling untold stories, thinking differently, and most of all, caring deeply for the well-being of others, we welcome Patrick Rodin. Patrick, thanks so much for being here.
Susie, thank you so much for inviting me. I am honored.
Patrick is a natural change maker. He has been caring for others as a nurse since 1985, so it's 40 years. It's a long time. He has been offering resources for people who want or need to age in place for many years. And last but not least, since he is a divergent thinker, and we'll talk more about this later, he did a PhD in gerontology and interviewed older artists and creatives to document the remarkable physical, cognitive, and emotional benefits of a sustained creative practice throughout life. Patrick, it is great to talk with a divergent thinker. Thanks for being here, sharing stories and your research about the creativity effect in healthy aging. We are all curious, how did this all start and what's your philosophy of aging?
Well, Susie, I'm a lifetime creative myself, and my mother was probably the most creative person I'd ever met. And in the course of my nursing and in my life in general, I just noticed that older artists seem to age differently than the population in general. I wanted to find out why, and so I made it a formal study. I wanted to look at how older artists, lifetime artists, handled their age-related losses through their creative process. And I met some fascinating people that we have talked about.
Since you studied gerontology, there is the traditional gerontology, which looks at aging really from a medical perspective. And then there's the critical theory, which you subscribe to. Can you talk a little bit about this and why this is really important that we pay attention to that?
Susie, this is a great question, and this is fundamental. So in 1992, I started my course in studying gerontology, which is the study of aging. And at that time, there were really two main camps of thought: historical gerontology, which we all, I would argue, grew up with, your parents, your grandparents, and even a lot of us just have our views of aging under that umbrella of historical gerontology. And then there's another type of gerontology, which is completely the opposite, called critical gerontology. Let me describe the two real quick, because I think any discussion of aging needs to start here with a theory of gerontology and ask yourself, what theory of gerontology are you aging under? So historical gerontology started in the late 19th century, early 20th century, kind of the height of the industrial era. It was really privileged by the medical model, and it saw aging as a scientific problem. It was a disease to be cured by the medical model. And there's a term for it. Theorists called it the biomedicalization of aging. They used the theme of peak and decline. You were like a machine, body as machine. You had a few good years, and like an old Buick, you started to wear out, and then they just threw you on the scrap heap. Now, come along around 1980, there were some feminist theorists and minority theorists who used something called critical theory. And they used this in the 60s and 70s to question cultural assumptions about women and minorities. Well, in the 1980s, these theorists used this same model to question cultural assumptions about aging. And it was diametrically opposed to this focus on medical decline. And one of the main theories underneath the umbrella of critical gerontology was something called the life course perspective. And it says that human development occurs all along the entire lifespan, not just at the beginning and then you decline, but entirely throughout your life, you're capable of human development. So that's the difference of the two. And this is a fundamental place to start.
Yeah, thank you. You talk about possibility aging, and that's very much related to this. I would love to ask what you mean by possibility aging. Then also, how is this sort of linked to the superpower of aging, which older artists have?
In studying these older artists, there were a lot of commonalities amongst them. And one of them was a concept called divergent thinking. Now, most of us were raised with convergent thinking. I was raised Catholic school. There was always one right answer to something. In multiple choice, there was one right answer. You converge down to the single right answer. That's the way I was raised. Well, these lifetime artists, since the day they started their creative process many decades ago, have experienced solving creative problems in more than one way, a divergent way. And by the time they were in their sixth, seventh, and eighth decade of solving creative problems in more than one way, they were really good at it. It was second nature to them. And it turns out that this is a superpower as you get older. It's a longevity strategy. And I can give you a couple examples of some of my respondents, two people in particular. The people I met during the course of my study were absolutely fascinating people. The first one was an 80-year-old artist. He had spent his life painting the figure, and he was used to painting straight lines. Well, as he got older, he developed an essential tremor. And if you know anything about that sort of Parkinson type of tremor, the more you try to do something fine and detailed, the worse the tremor gets. So what he did is he thought divergently, how can I solve this problem? Now, his first solution wasn't a good one, but he was in the process. What he found out that he could have a cocktail before he did his painting, and somehow the alcohol smoothed out the essential tremor. So it was working temporarily, but he realized over time, for his health, this probably wasn't a good idea. So he rethought his process. And what he discovered he could do, he could put paint on canvas, lay down masking tape, paint over it, let it dry, pull up the tape, and he had, voila, perfect straight lines. And what this did, Susie, it launched him in a whole new direction of creativity. Now, had he been sort of working under the historic gerontology philosophy, he would have, at that choice point, decided that these age-related disabilities are going to do him in. He was going to surrender to the cultural ageism and stop his creativity. But instead, what he did was more along the lines of critical gerontology, where he used divergent thinking and thought of a way to solve this problem. And here's the take-home message again. The limitation, I put that in quotes, became a superpower because it launched him in a whole new direction of creativity. And he had gallery showings after that with this new style of painting. So that's one example. The other example is an 85-year-old gentleman. I'll call him Jim. And Jim was legally blind, and he had arthritis in his hands. And he was a lifetime artist himself. Well, one day he was washing a very delicate china porcelain cup that his sister had brought back from the Orient. And this was a meaningful object to him. And it was something that he absolutely loved and cherished. And one day he was washing it, and his hands were soapy and wet, and he dropped it in the sink. And it just shattered into dozens of pieces. And he looked at it. He had a moment of grief and loss, of course, and he was thinking, what am I going to tell my sister? But then he went into this divergent thinking mode. He fished out all the pieces, set them on a table, and took a couple days to think about this. And what he ended up doing was taking those pieces and incorporating them into a mosaic. And it's a beautiful mosaic with pale yellow tiles. It became something that he called Échec Échelle. He was very immersed in French culture from being in the war, World War II. And Échec Échelle just translates loosely to a ladder up. So again, had he been working under the influence of historic gerontology, he might have looked at that as, I'm blind, I can't see, I have arthritis, I'm so frustrated, I'm going to stop doing what I'm doing. But instead, he incorporated critical gerontology thinking, divergent thinking, and took that broken porcelain cup and made something extremely beautiful out of it. And he gave it to me before he passed away. And I always remember that concept of a échec échelle, or a ladder up. It's success in the midst of failure, essentially, is what it means. And so that's why it's important to know which theory you're working under, because the outcomes are totally different.
Yeah, what an amazing story of developing creativity out of a challenge. I'm curious, though, I would imagine that these respondents didn't know about historical gerontology, but they did this because they were both artists, no?
Oh, you've just nailed it. Good for you. That's the visceral question. So if somebody's listening to this, they'll go, well, what if I'm not an artist? What if I'm not a lifetime creative? The benefit is that you now know these two camps of gerontology. Which one are you working under? There's a line that says your biography becomes your biology. Essentially, how you live determines how you're going to age. And how you live and how you age is very much determined by your philosophy of aging. None of those artists knew the academic gerontology terms for historic versus critical gerontology. But as a lifetime artist, they were always working with the gerontological critical theory side of the ledger. And they were marginalized by creativity. One gentleman said that he was called the artsy one when he was growing up. These people were used to being culturally marginalized already because of their creativity. They didn't buy into the larger cultural narratives that want to peak and decline. This wasn't part of their thinking. So it was a superpower.
They were accustomed to be nimble, to find workarounds.
They were resilient and nimble. And you find out as you get older, these are longevity strategies of the older artists.
So something which also often comes up, you know, later in life, you might not be as productive. And productivity is so valued in our society. I wonder again how, from an artist's perspective, productivity can be seen or approached in later life.
This is a really great distinction you bring up, because historically, creativity was measured as productivity. Younger artists, younger scientists naturally put out more output. And so what historical gerontology has done is equated creativity with productivity, but they're actually measuring the wrong thing. I'm going to give you a crazy example just to make a point. Let's say you have a young AI artist on the computer, and in 1 year, that young AI artist can create 5,000 AI images of Pokemon. That's a lot of images. That's a lot of output. Maybe you have, in that same period of time in that year, one older artist who paints the Mona Lisa. Who's more creative? The one that produced 5,000 units or the one that produced one unit? It's not about outcome. You can't measure creativity in terms of outcome. You have to measure it where it happens, and that's in the creative process. Process is where creativity happens. That's where it should be measured. And there was no decline in creativity in older artists when you look at that as the barometer. So we get these ideas of creativity and we live with these and grow up with these, thinking that older artists aren't as creative. And that's just certainly not true. You're measuring the wrong thing.
One of the main things, or one of the critical things in older age, which often predates a decline, is a loss of purpose. As an artist, is there a loss of purpose when you can't produce that much anymore? Or if you have to change the way that you produce? Or is this identity so strong with creative or artistic people that it sort of survives changes in ability?
You're asking such good questions, Susie. Okay, so one of the other theories underneath the umbrella of critical gerontology is something called continuity of self. And continuity of self says that older adults will use strategies to maintain some kind of semblance of self in the midst of loss and change that really defines aging. And this has to do with ego integrity strength. Older artists, as they got older, they self-identify as artists. All of them did. So that was a solid identity in the midst of maybe losing physical prowesses, losing colleagues, losing titles, maybe losing jobs. So in the midst of change and loss, there was some semblance of self that was maintained, and it was their identity as an artist. And it turns out that this also is a longevity strategy, particularly unique to artists. You don't retire from being an artist. I saw people in South Florida when I worked in a trauma center there that retired from something to nothing. They didn't have a way to organize their lives anymore. And they took on one of the main premises of historical gerontology, the theory of disengagement. And even worse than disengagement, they engaged with the medical model. I saw this firsthand. They didn't have ways to organize their lives around career or child rearing that they once had. And they retired to Florida. Jonathan Winters called it God's waiting room because they went there to die, essentially. They went there solely to pursue leisure. And there wasn't a lot of meaning-making opportunities in that. And so what they did, they got real involved in what I called sick careers. They got real busy going to the doctor on Tuesday, picking up their medications on Wednesday, going to the physical therapist on Friday. And that's how they derived their meaning out of these sick careers. And I heard people in the lobby, they were just so involved with their ego and their disease decline process, because they were working under historical gerontology philosophy, essentially, that they got into competitive complaint. You got it so bad. I should have it so bad. And they took it like to Olympic heights. And this is the way that they were spending their so-called golden years. It wasn't a real positive way to age.
The sick career is a really odd sort of way to find a purpose. You said in the beginning that, and tell me if this is too personal, but you said that one of the most creative people you've known was your mom. I'm curious how this manifested, you know, in her aging process, her creative practice, and I assume divergent thinking.
My mother was a single mother. My father abandoned us. I don't get into it in too much detail, but she was left with three small kids, high school education and no driver's license. And she saw the world through a different interpretive filter. Through her, my other siblings were all very creative. The house was always messy because there was nobody to clean it up. But in the house, there were these little vignettes of visual delight that she would make. I mean, she used to wrap Christmas presents that you didn't want to unwrap. They were suitable for framing. And until I went to other people's houses, that's just what I thought, that's the way it was done. And when I went to other people's houses and saw how they wrapped their Christmas gifts, I went, oh my, maybe my family is special in that sense. My mother was very, very, very creative. And so instilled that in me. As she got older, she spent more time in creative pursuits. But she got it out in more practical ways, like the wrapping of gifts and things like that. It wasn't that she sat down and painted. And again, it's the way she looked at the world. It was through an artist's lens. It's almost hard to explain. It's something that you have to be around to understand. But she was immensely creative, just visual delight in all corners of this little messy house we lived in. She got it out in some form or another.
Thanks for sharing this. And this delightful environments, when we talked, you mentioned also the study of neurogenesis.
Do you mind if I talk about that for a minute?
No.
During this time, I was studying environmental gerontology, and this is what attracted me to your thinking, Susie, because you use this term delight, environmental delight. And some people might think that's a soft term or a fluffy sort of term, like you want to find a picture that matches with your couch for delight. But what I found in my studies, because I was interested to see if environmental aesthetics affects aging in some way, and I know you were interested in this too. Around that time, I found a neuroanatomist named Marion Diamond at UC Berkeley. And in the 1960s, she was bucking the trend of historical gerontology. Because historical gerontology taught us that we were born with a certain number of brain cells, like 100 billion brain cells and 10 trillion dendritic connections between those brain cells. And you were never going to get another one the rest of your life. It was only going to get smaller in number. Granted, that's a large number, but some of us don't have enough to spare. So this was bad news. Well, what she did was shown through her rat studies, and this is hard, rigorous science. I'll make it real quick. She had two groups of rats, one in non-stimulating environments. All the other factors were controlled. Another group of rats that were in stimulating environments, visual delight, wheels to play with, other rats to interact with, mirrors down the wall, and they changed out the environment frequently. So it's called environmental novelty and complexity. And we know from the MacArthur Foundation, 85% of people who live past the age of 65 have two things in common, whether they smoked or not, and the degree of complexity and novelty in their daily behavior. So what Marion Diamond showed on autopsy of these two groups of rats, the rats in the non-stimulating environments, the non-delight environments, if you will, they had dendritic and brain cell shrinkage, especially in the area of the hippocampus, which is the seat of memory. The other side of the ledger, the rats that were involved in these complex environments, they found out on autopsy their brains were rich with new brain cells and the dendritic connections between cells, particularly again in the area of the hippocampus and memory. So she bucked this trend. They called it neurogenesis. And since then, with technology, we've been able to translate this information over to human beings. For humans, it's the same thing. The science is there, and it's supportive of our idea of environmental delight, changing the architecture of one's brain. This was always my argument for not going into long-term care. Long-term care, the aesthetics are designed for efficiency, not for a person's own meaningful environment around aesthetics that delight their senses and support their identity. And this was one of my main arguments always for aging in place, environmental aesthetics.
Really good point. Also, what we learned through our workshops, for aging in place, people sometimes don't afford themselves delight because they're bombarded with advice for safety and delight is neglected, which is so much part of healthy aging. I would say the other thing in senior living environments, often the choice is not there. People are not given the choice to personalize environments. There are too many rules. And it's also too perfect. Something really beautiful about imperfection.
Oh, gosh. That was my mother. She instilled that in me. She didn't like perfection. She loved asymmetry. And that was the other thing in Jim, the blind artist. There wasn't a straight line in his house. All of them were rounded off and edged smooth. There was a theme in his life, and it meant something to me. There were no hard edges. It was a beautiful aesthetic. There is hard science that support visual delight in your environment.
Your research, you interviewed people who had lifelong practices as artists. Many of us do not.
Yep.
So what is your take on establishing a creative practice later? What does this really mean, establishing a creative practice? And is it too late, or can you still do this in your 80s?
To the people listening, I wanted to ask the question, do you consider yourself an artist or a creative? And if you do, then I have some really good news for you concerning your longevity. And there's the hard science behind that in the creative process itself. We talked about this. Each one of these artists talked about this in different terms of language, but they all described something of the ego dissolving into the work. So the creative process itself caused sort of a dissolving of the ego. And that put them into what's called flow states. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, in 1990, wrote a book called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. They found that when people are in these flow states, they are surging their bodies with positive chemistry, norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin. All these positive chemicals are surging through their bodies while they are in these flow states. And these artists had an opportunity almost daily to experience these flow states and dissolving of the ego. Older people, for the most part, don't have that opportunity, but yet these older artists were experiencing it almost daily and certainly weekly. The other benefit to this longevity-wise, studies show that how you feel about your own aging process, whether you see it as a time of growth, wisdom, and purpose, on average, you will live 7.5 years longer versus somebody who's working, again, under historic gerontology that sees it as a time of decline. They don't have that longevity benefit. So the creative process, getting into flow states, changing your body chemistry through these, and dissolving of the ego actually manifests as physiological benefits towards longevity. So there's reasons to take on a creative practice, and you can do it at any age. That's the good news.
So creative practice and complexity in your environment could also be as simple as, you know, trying a new restaurant every now and then, or turning left instead of right when you go out of your house.
Small choice points throughout the day. When people come back from vacation, they feel refreshed. Well, they have a different brain. They've changed the architecture, literally, of their brain. They've had to talk to different people, negotiate different restaurants, different foods, maybe spoke different languages. You are growing dendritic connections when you do something like that. And when you come back home, it becomes apparent that you feel refreshed. Well, actually, your brain's working better. You've changed the architecture. And if you're conscious of this, you can do it every day in everyday environments by being mindful and aware and awake and just noticing things. Awe is a lovely experience. Look out at the sunset or the ocean. You can create these kinds of neurochemical experiences that can make you feel better about your aging process.
Yes, awe is a wonderful age-friendly design principle. I totally agree.
Absolutely.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
Kathy asks, how would you relate what you're saying to musicians in other creative arts?
Anything that you can dissolve the ego in the creative process, where you become one or lose the sense of time or get into those flow states, absolutely. I have seen old guys in garages working on 46 Fords that are there. They're in that flow state.
Yes. Well, as children, you're often in flow states. That's this wonderful memory we all have, this carefree, totally focused state where you lose yourself into an activity.
Yeah. And, you know, that was the sad thing because I worked in nursing homes. I grew up in one. I spent the first 2 years of my life crawling around the floors of a nursing home in Astoria, Oregon. That's where I think this imprinted me. You know, they put people in wheelchairs and put them in front of a TV to be babysat by a TV. And you can just hear their dendritic connections shrinking from across the room. It's so sad to me that that's what we do. It's that disengagement theory all over again on a large, grand institutional scale. And that's, again, one of my arguments for aging in place, something called environmental press. You know, when we were younger, and say grandma was on the porch during the summertime rocking and she wanted a glass of lemonade, do you remember going up and saying, "Here, grandma, let me get that for you. You rest." Well, we were not doing grandma a favor. Rest showed respect, but grandma was probably 55 years old. She not only should have been getting the lemonade herself, but she should have been getting up and getting you one too. And that's called environmental press. But we developed a learned helplessness in a certain group of older adults by treating them with respect. They should rest. There's other ways to show respect, but that wasn't a good one. And again, that was under the umbrella of historic gerontology. You reached a certain age, you were supposed to rest. Bad model.
Some other comments and questions. Candice says, speaking of long-term care, there are a few residential communities for old adults formed around the arts, like Soho and Hollywood, California. What do you think of this concept in long-term care? I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I am, and there's somebody I actually follow on LinkedIn who is involved in an arts program. Just the look on these people's faces, it's almost palpable. They do these beautiful cards and mosaics. They do watercolors. And it's a chance to develop community, of course. A lot of these people, when they go into long-term care, they think they're going to have this great network of people. Well, I've seen a lot of people go into long-term care and they never go out of their room. They stay isolated. They'll go get their meal, but they'll go straight back to the room and stay isolated in a long-term care facility. The arts programs brings these people together. That social capital that they build during the creative process is a wonderful thing. So I'm highly supportive of that. And it gives these people a chance to get into these flow states and to lose their ego and not think about maybe some aches and pains that perhaps they have. And by the way, when I talked about sick careers, I'm not talking about happy gerontology here. I'm not denying the physical declines that happen with aging. I was a critical care nurse for 2.5 decades. I saw this. I know what's real about the physical declines in aging. There's no denying that. What I'm saying is these are strategies, positive strategies to deal with those.
Yes, thank you for adding this. That's really important.
If I could add something now, Patrick inspired me. I was a nursing home administrator in my youth. And one of the things I realized was that the philosophy and the attitude of management can have so much to do with the quality of life of people that are in a place that need to be there for a reason.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the things that I learned was that if you open your eyes and you pay attention to the people, you can open up some things for them. Ralph was a fellow that was in our nursing home, and he noticed that people came and went from my office. I was the administrator. People wanted to come in and get changed so that they could use the soda machine. He came to me one day and he said, "You know, I noticed that people come and go a lot from your office and they must disturb you." He said, "If you give me $10 worth of change, I'd love to be near the lobby. People could come to me and I could make the change and you wouldn't be bothered." And I thought, I'd like to do that. So I gave him the change, and sure enough, over the months, people would go, he'd make their change. When he had given it all out, he'd come and we'd exchange again. One day, Ralph came to me and he said, "Mr. Milford, I want to put up my own money and people can come to me and we'll take care of this," and so forth and so on. And I said, "That's fine." You know, that gave him a purpose. And I thought that was a good thing to do. If you see the need and you can attend to it, then it gives them an opportunity to grow.
Good points and a beautiful story.
Thanks, John. Some other statements and questions. Diane says, I think gardening can be a flow and awe process.
Absolutely. I'm going to try gardening myself, by the way. Something I haven't done.
Rachel says, I bet flow states are very similar to meditative states biochemically.
Agreed. Yep.
Another question from Francisco. How can someone after 65 and retired find meaning in life if art is not motivating? What else can be a creative practice?
This is a very, very, very good question and an easy one to answer. Volunteer. Service to others. You know what I would like to do? I would like to go to shelters and walk shelter dogs for the day. Take them out. You get exercise and you walk the shelter dog and maybe it'll get adopted. There was a book called The Healing Power of Doing Good. And it was hard science showing that you can heal your body in favor of longevity, change your chemistry by simply volunteering. And I actually met the author, Alan Lukes, and he was the president of the Big Brother, Big Sister program in New York City. They did medical studies on volunteers, and they found out that through volunteering, they were changing their chemistry in favor of longevity. But that's an answer, the volunteer. You can change your biochemistry through volunteering.
Yes, doing good. Thank you. Rachel says, what can people do who are highly limited by pain or age-related impairment? Engaging the old, or people with advanced cognitive problems can be the real challenge because of a lack of resources.
Oh, very good question. I would try to find a creative buddy, an outlet. If you have some social network, like maybe a book club, I don't know how computer savvy this person might be, but certainly online, you don't have to leave home and you can find all kinds of clubs. I'm actually in the process of writing a murder mystery novel, and I'm teaching gerontological theories through a murder mystery. And I'm hoping it will be picked up by a group like that online. But that is a very good question and a very challenging one. I would try to look for a creative buddy to help and maybe a technological outlet if there is one, join with a group of other creatives online.
Yeah, pain is a very distracting sensation, and it's probably very difficult to get into a flow state for somebody.
It absolutely would be. I agree with that. But if you could, you could have the benefits of that positive chemistry. And studies have shown that norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin are good for pain control. So if there's some way you could find to elicit that, it would certainly help with chronic pain.
Yeah, thank you. Delia says, my experience has been writing about art, and I have continued to explore art and creativity through my writing. It is about remaining curious and wanting to learn and to keep your brain active and expanding.
She nailed it. Curiosity. And I've written about this over and over and over again. Stay curious. That is a longevity strategy. Stay curious about your surroundings, about the world, about yourself. Stay curious. I would like to have a t-shirt that says that. Remember Life magazine, the old black and white Life magazine? I remember years and years and years ago, there was this couple from the 60s and they were looking at this Picasso on the wall, and the kids down below were looking through a grade, a vent at foot level. And the title of it was Stay Curious. And I absolutely loved that. Picasso stayed curious. Rembrandt, Matisse, they all stayed curious until the very last breath. That's the key.
It's a great recipe. And it feels really good to be curious.
It does. And it leads you to serendipity, where wonderful things happen.
Exactly. So Yasmin says, I worked as a caregiver and art director at an anthroposophical Waldorf intergenerational community centered around the care of the human being and the land. I experienced many of the aspects of positive aging you're describing. I didn't meet a single person who didn't have a creative energy. Simple acts like cleaning cutlery was an art. Weeding and vacuuming could be artistic.
I think what Yasmin is describing is mindfulness. It sounds like mindfulness. It's interesting because that's what these creatives across the board, they had cultivated mindfulness. They did things intentionally. And remember we talked about this before? Another benefit to this was something called future tense. And when I went to interview these people, it was usually in their studios. So they had something out that they were currently working on. Have you seen my latest? I heard that a lot. Have you seen my latest? So they were focused in the now, but they always had something on the back burner that they were going to get to, something on deck. It was a future tense. So present tense and a future tense. They didn't focus much on the past or loss. It was always, what's my next project? And that was another strategy for longevity that I found. And it was across the board. All of them had something they were working on and something they were looking forward to working on.
Well, it makes me very optimistic, really, to think about this, you know, about the many projects ahead with curiosity and a creative spirit. The future tense, I think that's really important. Patricia says, let's not forget forest bathing.
Absolutely. I mean, to talk about the aging in place part of this, if you're looking for like the 10 elements of a home in high demand for an aging population, Susie, it's like your home. You are near a green space. You can walk out your front door as I can and be in nature really quickly. And again, the infusion of positive chemistry through visual delight. There it is. Forest bathing is the perfect example and another crossover to this theory that we're talking about.
Yes, and we're always talking about in our workshops, Aging 360 workshops, not everybody has the possibility to go outside. There's often a possibility to bring nature inside, you know, a sprig of green or a plant or whatever it may be, but there's always possibility to bring nature inside.
Biomimicry. Yeah, our friend on LinkedIn, Linda Kafka, works substantially with aging in place and the aesthetics and the environment. And biomimicry is something she's very attuned to and espouses. And you're right. There's studies that show if a patient in a hospital is looking out the window at some greenery, like trees and things, they heal faster. I mean, there's empirical evidence for that. The studies are pretty robust. Again, delight, environmental delight.
So Cindy says, I've been a psychotherapist and writer and journaler for many years and now teach self-reflective journaling on Zoom. I still work, teach Centre therapy, and am intrigued by your phrase, divergent thinking. I think I have been this way my whole life, and it feels good to find a name for what I have felt. Thank you, Patrick.
It's nice to language things, isn't it? But she brings up a really good point, a larger point. To me, it's fundamental to understand historic gerontology and critical gerontology. Which one of these have you been aging under? Remember, your biography becomes your biology. Concerning aging, your self-talk is coming from either that camp or this camp. And I catch myself occasionally saying, am I too old to do this? Wait a minute. I have this burden of insight. No. My aunt lived to be 96. She was 90 when she got laid off. She worked the same job from 20 to 90. She buried three bosses. And she was so mad when they downsized her at 90, she was going to sue them for age discrimination. My aunt exercised every night before she came home, did yoga at the YMCA. She was active in her community. She donated 90 gallons, Susie, of blood in her lifetime to the Red Cross. 90 gallons. She had community. She had family. She raised us because we didn't have a father. She took us in. So she was a tremendous human being. And she was a hiker, an outdoors person. She never got married. But she was always up for an adventure. Even into her advanced age, when I would take her out in her wheelchair, she was up for an adventure. Not once did she say, no, I'm too tired to go today. She was always ready for an adventure. When you list these things, she was successfully aging. I mean, she was a great role model for me.
Yeah, it seems like you were surrounded by great role models who inspired you.
I was lucky.
Yes. And just not saying no, I think that's also something wonderful to keep in mind. mean, honestly, I say no now more than I should. And it's just a good reminder that you should say yes, because you never know.
Do you remember Bill Thomas, Dr. Bill Thomas, the geriatrician, the Eden Alternative?
Yes.
I want the people listening here to go on YouTube and look up Bill Thomas and upside risk. Bill talked about something called upside risk versus downside risk when you talk about seniors and particularly aging in place. He said, when you talk about seniors living alone, the first thing that people think about is, oh no, that's risky. Oh no, they shouldn't do that. You tend to think first of downside risk. That's historical gerontology. He said, you know, when you think about risk, the definition of it is just an outcome that's other than expected. It doesn't have to always be a downside. There can be an upside to risk. That's critical gerontology. Do you see the two? Downside risk, upside risk. And he said, why is it that we treat seniors like no other sector of the population and think only about the downside risk to anything? During COVID, my aunt was isolated. It was starting to get to her. And I had to make a better bad choice. Do I take her out or do I sequester her? I chose to take her out because I knew that's what she wanted. And there was an upside risk to that. Turns out it was the right decision. She lived more years because of that. Look that up on YouTube. It's probably from 15 years ago. Bill Thomas is an amazing geriatrician. He's a physician, geriatrician, and he's all about critical gerontology. Focus on the upside of risk. Don't go directly knee-jerk to the downside of risk when you talk about older adults.
Well, Patrick, you gave us some great words to anchor us, from curiosity to divergent thinking to upside risk to the superpower of aging to future tense. That's a big trove, a real resource. Lots to do in the future for all of us.
There were a lot of concepts we didn't get to, but I put the high points on a handout that I want the listeners here to have, because I want them to go and maybe pursue some of these reference trees and just kind of incorporate in their own lives or the people they love.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this inspiring conversation. We all will go out into the world and be curious and take the upside risk after this conversation, I'm sure. Thank you all for listening. And Patrick, again, thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Susie. It was a delight.
It was a delight.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.